Hundreds of reporters gathering the news and the views of the most seasoned experts on international issues. Tune in Monday through Friday at 17 UTC and 2230 UTC. We're also available online at voanews.com.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning into the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 1630 and 1830 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. It's the sunny side of sports right here on the Voice of America.
Friends, we can all listen to the sunny side of sports.
Great show, bro. This is Sunny Side of Sports.
Right here on the Voice of America.
Voice of America.
This is VOA's Sonny Young in Washington. Welcome to the sunny side of sports. Let's kick off in Istanbul, Turkey, where Liverpool edged Chelsea 5-4 on penalty kicks in the first all-English UEFA Super Cup football match. Now, the annual UEFA Super Cup features the winners of the Champions League and Europa League tournaments. Liverpool's newly acquired Spanish goalkeeper, Adrian, made a crucial save with his leg to deny Tammy Abraham in the penalty kick shootout. At the post-match news conference, Liverpool's German manager, Jurgen Klopp, praised Adrian.
He played an incredible game. He had sensational saves. Both goalies had that. But maybe from Adrian, it's a bit more surprising because, without pretty much any preparation with having 15 minutes. I don't know when he played the last game for West Ham, to be honest. So it's a while ago. Being ready like he was ready tonight is incredible. And he's not only on the pitch, a great person. So he showed me already that he's a proper personality in the dressing room as well. He was maybe louder than I was in halftime. I was not loud because I wanted to give some informations, but he was really on his toes. So and that was good and it's important and helps us. And he deserves that. Of course, in penalty shoot, he's always lucky, but the performance over 120 minutes was incredible. Making the save for the penalty is the icing on the cake and is wonderful. I saw now one time that he could really grab his towel before he started celebrating. That's special as well. So obviously quick in mind and knows what he wants to do. Helped us a lot and he can be really proud of what he did tonight.
I think Senegalese star Sadio Mane also can be really proud of what he did in the UEFA Super Cup match in Istanbul. The Liverpool winger scored goals in the 48th and 95th minutes and was named man of the match.
I think, it was really important for us to win this trophy because the world is here to win. So, we know that it was not our best game, but it's normal. It's part of football. And I think sometimes you don't need to play 100% or to play, to be physically 100% to win trophies. So I think, mentally we was here and we give everything until the end. I think, we deserve to win tonight and we are really proud and very happy.
While Sadio Mane says Liverpool deserved to win, Chelsea manager Frank Lampard says he thinks his team was the better side.
Clearly for me, I felt we were the stronger team. Some bad luck at times and maybe bad finishing for us, which we need to be more clinical on. But my overall feeling from the game is one of pride in the team performance and happiness. And I don't like losing. I'm a terrible loser and you should be. We are as Chelsea. We want to win this game. But we were very unfortunate today and I'm happy with the players. If that's a sign of what we can do this season and we will get better, then it's a really good sign.
Chelsea manager Frank Lampard speaking in Istanbul after his team's 5-4 loss to Liverpool on penalty kicks in the annual UEFA Super Cup match. Chelsea and Liverpool will now prepare for English Premier League matches this weekend. Chelsea is at home Sunday against Leicester City, And reigning European champion Liverpool has a road match Saturday against Southampton. I'm Sonny Young, and you're listening to the Sunny Side of Sports on the Voice of America. Now let's go to Kampala, where Uganda's boxing team, nicknamed the Bombers, have been training for the upcoming All-African Games in Morocco. Despite a shortage of resources, the Bombers say they're ready to fight for gold medals at Rabat 2019. And for the first time, Uganda will have female boxers trading punches at the continental competition. Magumi Davis Rakawinj tells us more from Kampala.
Left, right. Right, left, right. Double right. One, two.
Female boxing trainer Masemuka Nkusi engages two lady bombers as the Uganda female boxing team is called in a sparring session at Rosetta Prison Gym just a few meters away from Africa's biggest lake, Victoria. One of them is Jelia Nali. The 54 kilograms bantamweight fighter is one of the two Ugandan female boxers that will for the first time represent Uganda at the African Games competition.
I'm sure I'm going to do all my best to bring a medal to Uganda. And what I encourage my female boxers to do so hard that they can also make what we are doing.
Her sparring partner, Rebecca Mongi, will unfortunately not be part of the team traveling to Morocco. She says she was distraught when she was informed the decision that she won't represent at the game she ardently loves.
I came here and I learned very many things, like how to throw a punches, how to move, how to bow, those things. Yeah, I've learned a lot of things. So I was even ready to go there at Morocco to bring a gold medal. But bad luck, I'm not the one of the boxers which is going to Morocco.
Ali, hard punch on front. Two, yeah. Abaka. Two. Right,
that's right. Isaac Masembe fights in the bantamweight male category. Masembe says he will fight for gold and make his colleagues who didn't represent proud.
They didn't choose us because they liked us personally. They chose us because they knew that we are good. We are good in what we are doing and we prepared very good, very well. My main strength is my right hand. My right hand. When my right hand lands on you, I don't think that you can stay up.
Masembe is grateful to have made it out of the more than 350 fighters that have been training for close to 3 months and passed the various trials. Zebra Senyange, popularly known as Mando, the team manager, says he was disappointed when he was informed that he will only take 8 boxers at the Continental event.
There's no way you're going to determine on the 49 kg with the 91 who is going to be better because they will not box. You never know. These are medals. You can refuse to take the lightweight, the small weight, and then he's the one who's going to make a draw to the finals in a medal bracket. So it was just tricky, and it's your testing, and it makes disappointments in a camp. Boys will look at you like, coach left me out, the manager left me out, and it's not good, really.
Nevertheless, Mando, the former middleweight boxer who captained the national team at the All African Games in Maputo, Mozambique, in 2011, says the Bombers will win the medals in both boys and female categories. Masemuka Nkusi agrees. She says what boys can do, girls can even do it better.
AIBA has given the girls the opportunity, most girls the opportunity to go and box, because they have seen girls can make it. And right now, if girls train more, I know they will bring medals in Uganda.
AIBA stands for the International Boxing Association, a sports organization that organizes amateur boxing competitions. For the Sunny Side of Sports, I am Mugume, Davis Rwakarinji, Kampala, Uganda.
Thanks, Magumi, and good luck to the Bombers in Rabat. The 12th All-African Games are scheduled to begin Monday, August 19th in Morocco, and they'll go through August 31st. The African Games will feature competition in boxing and 25 other sports. I'm Sonny Young, and you're listening to the Sunny Side of Sports on the Voice of America. Let's take a break now for these VOA programming announcements.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's newsmaker interview program. Join us each Saturday and Sunday when we talk with authors, analysts, and policymakers who provide fresh insight on topics ranging from U.S. politics and foreign policy to science, culture, and global health. You can listen to Press Conference USA on the radio or online at voanews.com/PCUSA. While you're visiting our website, be sure to subscribe to our podcast. We'd also love to hear from you. Just send an email to pcusa@voanews.com or connect with us on Facebook at facebook.com/CarolCastielVOA or on Twitter at CarolCastielVOA. That's Press Conference USA every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
Hi, I'm Helen Maroulis, Olympic champion for Team USA, and you're listening to the Sunny Side of Sports on The Voice of America.
Want to relax, unwind, or charge up? Then listen to Music Time in Africa this weekend. It'll do all that for you and more. I'm Heather Maxwell. I know good music. And Africa is my passion. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for 1 hour of commercial-free Pan-African music of the highest caliber. You get great music, music news, and amazing artist interviews from rising stars to superstars. This listen will take you places. So do it. Join me for Music Time in Africa, your weekend destination.
They're playing basketball. We love that basketball.
A top National Basketball Association executive is continuing his efforts to grow the sport in Africa by recently holding a developmental camp in Cameroon. My VOA colleague Jim Stevenson has that story as well as a package of tennis news.
Toronto Raptors president Masai Ujiri visited Cameroon to host a youth basketball camp.
There's so much talent in Africa. We have to be able to help this talent, groom this talent, and that's by increasing facilities, help with coaching, infrastructure. We have to be disciplined on the continent.
Following his team's first National Basketball Association championship, the English-born Nigerian is also on the lookout for some talent, with a number of African stars currently making their mark in the NBA.
We've seen now that how kids can come out of here, kids like Joel Embiid and Pascal Siakam can come out of places like this and be great. And there's no reason why we can't inspire to be better on this continent.
I want to hear. Eyes up.
Ujiri has previously held camps in Rwanda, Kenya, and Nigeria with the aim of bringing young people together through sports values such as tolerance, respect for gender, and work ethic. He says basketball opens many opportunities.
We're not all going to end up being basketball players. Some of us are going to end up being coaches, working basketball in other areas. We can be sports journalists, we can be sports lawyers, we can be sports doctors, we can be sports trainers. There are so many things that you can do, and we have to teach these kids. As they use basketball as a path, these opportunities can come their way with education.
Rafa did it very well. So.
Rafael Nadal did do very well, winning in Montreal with a 6-3, 6-love win in the final against Daniil Medvedev.
I played a solid match, my best match of the week so far, without a doubt. I did a lot of things well, changing directions, changing rhythms, during the point. I played some high balls, then changed it down the line. I think I played smart because I had a good feeling on the ball. If not, you cannot.
Nadal says he got off to a good start in his first successful defense of a hard court title.
Some very long rallies, and for me personally, it was important to start the match in a good shape, you know, because he came to that match playing so well during the whole event, playing a lot of matches the last weeks. So for me, it was a little different story. You know, I only played 3 matches on hard before this one, and playing against a big opponent like him, for me, was important in the beginning of the match.
Medvedev knew he was facing one of the all-time best in the 33-year-old Nadal.
Well, I played Roger 2 times, Novak 4 times, so I knew how it's going to be, and I was kind of ready for it. And then didn't manage to probably show my best tennis, but at the same time, Rafa was, I think, incredible today.
Medvedev had a plan.
My tactic was to not go and give him that much time, to try to play deep, to not give him easy shots. And it was kind of working in the beginning of the match, but then I completely lost the momentum, and it was only him controlling the play, controlling the game. Even a few moments in the match, I tried to kind of not come back, but at least win one game and maybe see how it goes. The moment I was close, he just played too good, and that's how it went.
Nadal wasn't taking his less experienced opponent lightly.
Of course, I cannot be 100% calm, knowing that I'm going to win the match. And probably for that reason, I achieved all the things that I achieved, you know, because I am never too confident. I always respect every situation and every opponent, and that's why I am always putting my 100% attention.
Medvedev felt he had one of his best career performances.
Yeah, I think it's one of 2 best tournaments I've played in my life. One was basically, of course, Tokyo, the only ATP 500 I won at this moment, and of course, to be in the final of Masters 1000, I mean, it's an amazing achievement for me at this moment. Of course, I always say this, if you don't win the tournament, you are always disappointed. I think even if you lose in the final of Grand Slam, you will be disappointed. But of course, I'm happy to be in this final, and I will try to do better next time.
Nadal has now won the Montreal event 5 times to push his record to 53 so-called big titles, a combination of 18 Grand Slam championships and a record-extending 35 ATP Masters 1000 titles. He is just one big title from matching Novak Djokovic and Roger Federer.
They're very passionate about tennis. I always felt that when I have been playing here, I have been always an unbelievable atmosphere out there, full crowd, and that's so important for our sport, no? And for me personally, go around the world and see when I'm playing, see the court full is a big personal satisfaction.
Andy Murray of Britain tried his luck in his first singles match since hip surgery.
I don't really know what I was expecting, to be honest. I think I did okay. I think, you know, you also have to be somewhat realistic.
He felt a bit off after a 7-month absence from singles tennis.
Physically, you know, my legs were a little bit heavy at the end of the match in comparison to maybe what they normally would be if you played, you know, a bunch.
Murray lost his first round match against Frenchman Richard Gasquet at the Cincinnati Masters 6-4, 6-4.
Richard uses all of the angles on the court. He's one of the best at doing that, so I was having to move quite a lot laterally, and I didn't move forwards particularly well. Like when he drop shotted, there was a few times I just didn't even run for the ball, didn't react to it, and that's nothing to do with, you know, my hip. That's just me not running for a ball, and I could have, which I did do that better at the end of the match.
Murray is in no hurry.
I haven't played many matches in the last 18 months really, so it's going to take time.
He confirmed he will not play singles at the forthcoming U.S. Open.
I'm not going to play the U.S. Open singles. They were announcing the wild cards today. I know if I would have taken the wild card and then not played, then I would have been getting all of the questions about my hip and why has he turned it down? Is something wrong? What's the problem? And, you know, that didn't feel right to me.
The 32-year-old Murray was very emotional last year when he faced the prospect of never playing tennis again.
Tennis is, you know, something that I've done my whole life, so it's something that is kind of all I've known as an adult. You know, I wasn't able to do that and didn't know whether I was going to be able to come back and play. That was, you know, that was hard. But actually, once I got rid of the pain, I realized that, you know, I didn't need tennis. Tennis wasn't the most important thing for me.
The first round loss tells Murray he's actually okay.
You know, I thought it maybe would have changed my perspective completely on things, but I'm sitting here disappointed, which I think is probably a good thing if I want to get back to playing at a high level.
In that first phase, it is incredibly painful to a point where I usually don't get out of bed.
Also facing down pain was American Serena Williams. Back spasms forced her out of the Rogers Cup final in Toronto.
It started yesterday in my match. It just got worse. It's just my whole back just completely spasmed, and to a point where I couldn't sleep and I couldn't really move. And so I was just trying to figure out how do you play a match where you have no rotation.
The 23-time Grand Slam champion made it through four games of the opening set, but was forced to retire from the match when the pain became too much.
I've had these awful spasms a lot in my career, actually, and they're incredibly painful. But, you know, it goes away after like 24, 36, maybe 48 hours, like clockwork.
Williams' opponent, 19-year-old Bianca Andreescu, took the title in front of the hometown crowd. But instead of immediately celebrating, the Canadian rushed to comfort Williams, who was visibly upset on the sideline.
Thanks, Jim. That's my VOA colleague, Jim Stevenson. Serena Williams also withdrew from this week's Cincinnati Masters tournament in Ohio, citing those same back spasms. The 37-year-old Williams is hoping her back feels better, and she's at full strength for the start of the U.S. Open, which begins August 26th in New York. Now, if Serena wins the U.S. Open, she'll tie the Australian Margaret Court's all-time record of 24 major titles. In last year's U.S. Open women's singles final, Serena Williams lost to Japan's Naomi Osaka in a match that was overshadowed by Serena's controversial argument with Portuguese tennis umpire Carlos Ramos. I'm Sonny Young, and you're listening to the Sunny Side of Sports on the Voice of America. More tennis news. 2019 Wimbledon champion Simona Halep had no problems with her left Achilles Wednesday as she rallied to beat Russia's Ekaterina Alexandrova in three sets at the Cincinnati Masters tournament. The final score, 3-6, 7-5, and 6-4. The win came 1 week after Halep dropped out of the Rogers Cup quarterfinals in Canada because of that Achilles injury. In more results from the Cincinnati event, top-seeded Ashley Barty, the 2019 French Open winner, beat veteran Russian star Maria Sharapova 6-4 and 6-1. And second-seeded Naomi Osaka, who I mentioned earlier, beat Alexandra Sasnovich of Belarus in three sets. In pro boxing, world heavyweight champion Andy Ruiz is balking at fighting a rematch against Anthony Joshua in Saudi Arabia. Ruiz told fans during a live chat that he's not planning on having the fight in Saudi Arabia, as announced by Joshua's promoter, Eddie Hearn.
There was a lot of talk about where this fight would be held. Would it be back at Madison Square Garden? Would it be at the Millennium Stadium in Cardiff? The whole world will be watching this fight on December 7th, and I know that Saudi Arabia will be doing everything they can to make sure that this is an event that takes your breath away.
Is Eddie Hearn just blowing hot air about the Ruiz-Joshua rematch taking place in Saudi Arabia? Andy Ruiz says the rematch will be on his terms. He says, and I quote, AJ, he's scared. Hell yeah. Why do you think he's over there trying to make the fight in Saudi Arabia? For his part, Eddie Hearn told Sky Sports that Andy Ruiz absolutely will be fighting in Saudi Arabia. Eddie Hearn says, and I quote, "His choice is to have a legal battle that could put him out of boxing for years or to defend his belts for a lot of money against a guy he has already beaten. There isn't any doubt he will take the fight." Eddie Hearn says the contract for the rematch was signed at the first time Ruiz was inked for the first fight with Joshua. Andy Ruiz, a big upset winner over AJ. We gotta wait and see where that rematch will take place. And that wraps up the August 15th edition of the Sunny Side of Sports. Thanks to Voice of America producer Bill Werkinger. Thanks also to VOA engineer Aiden Utko. And thank you for tuning in. I'm VOA's Sonny Young in Washington, and that's the Sunny Side of Sports.
I get it.
Hello, I'm Douglas Simpoga, host of VOA's Reporters Roundtable. Join us every Thursday as we discuss important African topics and events. I'll have a panel of African journalists and expert guests to discuss the topic at hand. We take a deeper look at important African news topics. That's Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
Hello, Africa. I'm James Butte, host of VOA's Daybreak Africa. When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you the news as it happens. Listen to Daybreak Africa Monday through Friday at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC. And our 5-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African beat. African Beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bobo music to hip life, bongo flavor to soukous, Afrobeat to dumbolo and makossa to kwaito. The African Beat on VOA has it all. And it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09:05 and 20:05 UTC, right after the international news.
This is Science in a Minute.
At the center of the Milky Way, 26,000 light years away, lies a supermassive black hole named Sagittarius A star. Astronomers have calculated the giant black hole has a mass equal to about 4 million suns and stretches across a distance of 44 million kilometers. According to his Twitter posts, Tuan Do, an astronomer at UCLA, and a team of colleagues were observing the black hole in the infrared wavelength this past May when they noticed it got 75 times brighter over a 2-hour period. In a follow-up tweet, the astronomer suggests that since the black hole itself doesn't produce light, the variations in brightness are coming from the light produced by hot gas falling towards the black hole, and that the increased activity is probably related to changes in the flow of gas. Astronomers say further observations may provide clues as to what is causing the black hole's increased brightness. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Hello, thank you for listening to Border Crossings with Larry London. This month, Border Crossings is giving away a really cool Voice of America t-shirt. Hooray! If you want to win one of these awesome shirts, all you have to do is make a song request for our show.
I see it, I like it, I want it, I got it, yeah.
Tune into Border Crossings at 1500 Universal Time every weekday in August for your chance to win.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, historically black colleges and universities in the United States have also educated prominent Africans, like the founding presidents of Nigeria, Ghana, and Malawi. The role of historically black colleges and universities on the continent on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
VOA's Learning English is available online at learningenglish.voanews.com. voaa.com. Check out our programs such as Let's Learn English, English in a Minute, Everyday Grammar, and many more. VOA's Learning English, your reliable source for learning English.
The Voice of America's flagship global news program, International Edition, brings you an in-depth look at the biggest stories of the day. Nobody covers the world more comprehensively than VOA. We have hundreds of reporters gathering the news and the views of the most seasoned experts on international issues. Tune in Monday through Friday at 17 UTC and 2230 UTC. We're also available online at voanews.com.
We are always glad to have our listeners throughout Africa tuning in to our newscasts, covering African news. Tune in on top of each hour, 24/7. VOA is your trusted source of news and information.
This is VOA News. I'm David Byrd. Israel has barred two U.S. lawmakers from entering the country, setting off a new round of controversy in the debate over U.S. support for its ally in the Middle East. As AP's Sagar Meghani reports, Democratic Congresswomen Ilhan Omar and Rashida Tlaib have been vocal critics of Israel and its treatment of Palestinians.
Ilhan Omar and Rashida Tlaib are outspoken critics of how Israel treats Palestinians, and both support a boycott of the Jewish state, which in turn says it will not let the lawmakers enter ahead of a planned visit.
What they're trying to do is really undermine the very legitimacy and existence of the state of Israel.
Danny Ayalon, a former Israeli ambassador to the U.S., says it was a no-win situation for Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. With Israel now wading deeply into America's partisan divide, the decision to bar Omar and Tlaib came not long after President Trump tweeted that Israel would show great weakness by letting them in. Sagar Meghani, Washington.
U.S. President Donald Trump suggested early Thursday that China's President Xi Jinping should meet personally with pro-democracy protesters in Hong Kong to resolve 10 weeks of demonstrations against Beijing's control. The president made the suggestion in a tweet. China's ambassador to London, Liu Xiaoming, warned Thursday that Beijing will not sit by and watch as the protests mount.
We've never allowed anyone to harm the rule of law and sound development in Hong Kong. We've never allowed anyone to undermine one country, two systems, at any excuse.
The U.S. and China are in the midst of contentious, drawn-out trade negotiations, but Trump suggested any trade resolution can be delayed as long as the protests continue. This is VOA News. Gibraltar has released an Iranian oil tanker detained by British Marines last month. We get details from Reuters correspondent Lucy Fielder.
The supertanker Grace One was seized on suspicion of carrying oil to Syria, in defiance of European sanctions. Then Iran seized a British tanker, the Stena Impero, in apparent retaliation. The tale of two tankers is deeply entangled with the diplomatic standoff between Iran and the West. There was no immediate news of a reciprocal release by Iran. A spokesman for Stena Impero said they were still awaiting developments.
Lucy Fielder of Reuters. Pakistan says three of its soldiers were killed Thursday in clashes with India across the disputed Kashmir border, known as the Line of Control. A Pakistani army spokesman said five Indian soldiers were also killed in retaliatory fire. Major General Asif Ghaffour said skirmishes were ongoing intermittently. Indian military officials are reported as denying any of their personnel were killed, but they did confirm that three Pakistani forces were killed in retaliatory action. It was not possible to seek immediate confirmation of claims made by both sides. Consumer confidence in the United States remains strong despite concerns over weakening economic growth and a persistent trade war with China. AP's Mike Hempen has more.
The Commerce Department says retail sales rose a healthy 0.7% in July. Online retailers, grocery stores, clothing retailers, and electronics and appliance stores all reported strong gains. Consumer spending, the primary driver of the U.S. economy, appears healthy, with wages increasing modestly, giving Americans more spending power. The U.S.-China trade conflict has triggered worries about a recession, but most economists are not forecasting a recession, mainly due to consumer spending and the job market remaining strong. Mike Hemp in Washington.
Washington's top two intelligence officials are spending their last day on the job as U.S. President Donald Trump oversees an overhaul of his intelligence leadership. Director of National Intelligence Dan Coats and his top deputy, Sue Gordon, are leaving as tensions rise between China and a protest movement in Hong Kong, while other potential crises, simmer in the Persian Gulf and on the Korean Peninsula. Trump announced Coates' resignation on Twitter late last month and followed up less than 2 weeks later with a tweet about the resignation of Principal Deputy Director Sue Gordon. For now, Joseph McGuire, a retired admiral and former Navy SEAL who had been serving as the National Counterterrorism Center Chief, will serve as acting director. I'm David Byrne, VOA News.
It's Thursday, August 15th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Dan Friedel in Washington. Coming up,
Israel today changed its mind. I think Israel said they had concerns that if they went through with that plan, that there would be violence.
Also ahead, U.S. National Security Advisor John Bolton talks with Greta Van Susteren about why China wants to make sure the protests in Hong Kong don't become this generation's Tiananmen Square. Those stories and more coming up on International Edition. We're joined now on International Edition by VOA's national correspondent Jim Malone. Welcome to the show, Jim.
Hi, Dan.
So, Jim, when Donald Trump was running for president in the fall of 2016, he ran on a platform of building a wall between the U.S. and Mexico and bringing jobs back to the U.S. that had been outsourced to other countries and renegotiating trade deals and so forth and so on. And we've seen over the last 3 years, he's continued to push for the wall. He's implemented tariffs on billions of dollars of Chinese goods. He's pushed for a top-down tax cut early in the first part of his presidency and generally seen the U.S. economy at least not slow down. But we've seen the major U.S. stock indices reach record highs, but a lot of volatility. I'm talking about what we saw in late 2018 and, of course, the whipsawing of the last couple days. And some analysts are worried that a recession is on the horizon. So if there is an economic downturn in the U.S. between now and a year from now, people might start lacking confidence in their investments and the security of their jobs. Can Donald Trump win another term?
It's a great question, and it's a question I think that they are mulling over very closely at the White House, especially the president. Look, this president has done a lot of controversial things. He has a controversial record. The one bedrock of consistency that he wants to be able to point to in his first term is a strong U.S. economy, consumer confidence, a low jobless rate, high growths in the economy. But the last few days, now with these fears of possible global recession, possible recession here in the United States, I think that this could be sending political shockwaves through the White House because this is the last thing they want heading into an election year. You know, if you look back over the last 50, 60 years, generally presidents who are in a recession do not get reelected. And presidents who are heading into a re-election battle with a strong, vibrant, growing economy, generally they win re-election. So the president wants, he actually needs this bedrock of a strong economy because if you look at his approval ratings, he gets pretty good numbers on the economy, his handling of the economy. But his overall approvals are always in the low 40s or so, which shows that people kind of support him on the economy, but not on other things. If he loses the economy as his underpinning, I think he'll be in serious political trouble.
That's a good point, Jim. So we've heard all this rhetoric from Trump about renegotiating the Trans-Pacific trade deals and holding a hard line on his negotiations with China and the tariffs. But just this week, the Trump administration decided to hold off on enforcing tariffs on about $150 billion worth of Chinese goods. That was supposed to come into effect on September 1st. Now it's being pushed back to December. Does that show some anxiety on his part that the reelection might not be as smooth sailing as he thinks it'll be?
I think that's a great example of the concerns, the worry in the White House about the economy. I think that was pretty clearly driven by domestic politics and the need by the White House, by the president, to avoid triggering something that could make the economic situation worse and perhaps spur a recession. If you combine that decision to delay on the tariffs with an earlier decision by the president not to engage in sort of a budget battle in Congress, perhaps over his border wall or other issues, I think that's clearly a sign that the number one thing on his mind is trying to do everything he can to shore up the economy. If you listen to the Democrats on the campaign trail, they've been bashing him right and left for the tax cut that they say mainly helped the wealthy, did not really resonate with workers. So the president was already struggling on that particular issue. But if he loses steam again because of the China trade standoff, because of rising consumer worries and then a lack of spending, consumer spending, I think it could all lead to an economy headed in the wrong direction just as he gets geared up for reelection.
Thanks for that, Jim. It'll be interesting to see how that plays out. And, you know, when the Congress comes back from its recess in a couple of weeks, we'll see how that conversation continues the rest of 2019. Thanks very much for joining us, Jim.
You bet.
China's ambassador to Britain today said the Beijing government will not sit on its hands if the situation in Hong Kong continues to deteriorate after more than 2 months of protests. Ambassador Liao Xiaoming said at a news conference in London that if the protests become uncontrollable, then the central government has enough solutions and enough power within the limit of the basic law to quell any unrest swiftly. He said that referring to Hong Kong's mini-constitution adopted after the former British colony was handed over to China in 1997. Since June, protests against government plans to pass a law allowing extradition to mainland China have paralyzed parts of Hong Kong. Protesters have expanded their demands to include the resignation of the city's Beijing-backed leader and an investigation into what they say were police abuses in dealing with the demonstrators. VOA contributor Greta Van Susteren this week sat down for an interview with U.S. National Security Advisor John Bolton. One of the issues they discussed was Hong Kong.
Well, you know, the Chinese have accused the United States of being the cause of all these demonstrations. They've said we're the black hand that's gotten all this started. And they've done things like publish private information about diplomats, U.S. diplomats in Hong Kong. That's the kind of thing that needs to stop. The Chinese have to look very carefully at the steps they take because people in America remember Tiananmen Square. They remember the picture of the man standing in front of the line of tanks. They remember the statue of Lady Liberty. They remember voices of the Chinese people asking for freedom and democracy, and they remember the repression of the Chinese government in 1989. It would be a big mistake to create a new memory like that in Hong Kong.
What's the cost, though, to China? I mean, those horrible memories that you just recited, I remember them. I remember watching them, but China's done fine in spite of that.
Well, that's one.
Why not take another round at it?
That one reason that we're engaged in a very difficult economic contest with China now is one reason that they did well after that was by stealing American intellectual property, engaging in forced technology transfer, and not just from the United States, but from Europe and Japan as well. Something like 60% of the investment in mainland China goes through Hong Kong. Why? Because it has a judicial system that's trustworthy based on the English model that we know in this country. The courts are thought to be impartial. If Hong Kong loses that reputation because of a bad decision by the Chinese government, they'll have significant economic consequences in China this time. And I can tell you from what I've heard just in the past few weeks, the mood in Congress is very volatile at this point. And a misstep by the Chinese government, I think, would cause an explosion on Capitol Hill.
What do you think President Xi is thinking about what's going on in Hong Kong?
Well, I think if he's worried about the steps that he might take in the future, he's also worried about the spirit that everybody else in China can see about Hong Kong. They want their freedom. And I think what the United States expects, at a minimum, is that China will uphold the treaty agreement it made with the United Kingdom when Hong Kong was handed back to China, the commitment for one country but two systems, that for 50 years after the handover, Hong Kong would maintain its unique system and the freedoms that were left to it by the British. If that treaty's violated, that's a significant credibility problem for Beijing.
That was U.S. National Security Advisor John Bolton speaking with VOA contributor Greta Van Susteren. We'll be bringing you more of the interview and the U.S. administration's foreign policy views in the coming days. Among the top stories in the world, U.S. President Donald Trump says a trade agreement with China could be delayed until it reaches a resolution with Hong Kong's pro-democracy demonstrators. International stock markets trembled over recession fears coming from three key market indicators in the U.S., Germany, and China. And six police officers were hurt in a standoff with a gunman in the northern part of the eastern U.S. city of Philadelphia. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the VOAnews.com website and our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Just a couple hours ago, news out of Israel that the country would not allow U.S. Congresswoman Rashida Tlaib of Michigan and Ilhan Omar of Minnesota to make a planned visit that just a week ago seemed to have plenty of support. Omar and Tlaib are Muslim-American first-term congresswomen who are supportive of Palestine and are in favor of the Boycott Israel movement. Just recently, Republican Representative Kevin McCarthy of California, he's the House Minority Leader, said he thought anyone who came to visit Israel with open eyes and an open mind should be welcomed. On the Democrat side, House Majority Leader Steny Hoyer agreed that the women should be allowed to visit. They're planning to visit the West Bank cities of Hebron, Ramallah, and Bethlehem, as well as Israeli-annexed East Jerusalem, including a visit to the controversial Al-Aqsa Mosque. The visit to the mosque is seen as controversial because it's both a holy site for Muslims and Jews. Now, some analysts believe a series of tweets from U.S. President Donald Trump put pressure on Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to prevent the women from entering Israel. Early Thursday morning, Trump used Twitter to say it would show great weakness if Israel allowed Representatives Omar and Tlaib to visit, and they hate Israel and all Jewish people. There's nothing that can be said or done to change their minds. We're joined now on International Edition by reporter Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem. As I described, Israel announced Thursday that the representatives would not be welcomed for their visit this weekend. Linda, why don't you explain for our listeners a little bit about the Boycott, Divest, and Sanction Israel movement and why the Congresswomen's support would make their visit controversial?
So it's called the BDS movement for short. And It's based on the idea of the South African divestment movement, that you can pressure Israel economically, and that if there's a boycott of Israel and Israeli academics and Israeli products, that would lead Israel to withdraw from the West Bank. Israel has been occupying the West Bank since 1967. It has not annexed it, but it continues to occupy it in a move that obviously Palestinians and much of the international community is very much against. Now, Israel has a law that people who support BDS can be barred entry into the country. In this case, originally, Israeli officials said they would let them in out of respect for the fact that they are congresswomen and would let them enter. However, Israel today changed its mind. I think Israel said they had concerns that if they went through with that plan, that there would be violence.
So, Linda, you know, the support that the congresswomen have shown for their platform isn't new. And, you know, just a month ago, the Israeli ambassador to the U.S. said his country wouldn't deny entry to any member of Congress. So why have they made this change? And does it have anything to do with Prime Minister Netanyahu's status ahead of the elections coming up in Israel in September?
Well, that's certainly sort of one theory, which is that, Israel is having a do-over election. There was an election in April, and while Netanyahu's Likud party got the most seats, it was unable to form a majority coalition. So now there's another election, and I think there's some concern. Netanyahu is certainly concerned and is fighting for the right-wing vote, and he's trying to show, because there's a sort of new party on his right wing that's potentially taking away votes from him, and he's trying to show that he is tough on these kinds of issues. Those in the center and the left in Israel say that the Israeli government is making a big mistake, that, you know, to deny two members of Congress makes Israel a partisan issue, where support for Israel used to be a nonpartisan issue. Republicans, Democrats, in fact, the largest arms, support of Israel, the largest support of Israel financially came from the Obama administration, which is certainly not Republican. So I think it's partly political from Netanyahu's point of view. It's possible that there's also pressure from the right wing in Israel to show just how tough Israel can be on these kinds of issues, and afraid of provocation. It's possible that there's also pressure from President Trump not to allow them in.
So, Linda, the conversation leading up to today's decision, some prominent former Israeli diplomats have said that Israel should not have prevented Omar and Tlaib from coming, but instead tried to encourage some kind of engaging conversation. So what do you think the average Israeli might say about the fact that their country has prevented them from coming to visit?
I think that most Israelis would say that they should come and they should see for themselves. And if they came and saw for themselves, they would see that Israel is not racist, that, you go on the light rail that goes down the center of Jerusalem, public transportation, and there are Jews and Arabs together. There are Arab citizens in the university. There are Palestinians from East Jerusalem learning in Israeli universities, that people work together, they shop together, they live together. So I think most Israelis think that it was a mistake. However, I think they also, Israelis do not support the BDS movement. And they think that while the BDS movement started as kind of a anti-occupation and to try to encourage Israel to leave the West Bank, many Israelis believe it has come to sort of undermine the legitimacy of Israel completely.
Okay, Linda, that's great. Thanks so much for joining us today on International Edition. It's great to have you on the show.
Thank you very much.
I'm Dan Friedel, and you're listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. The World Health Organization warns measles outbreaks are rapidly spreading because fewer people are getting vaccinated against this preventable disease. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from WHO headquarters in Geneva.
The UN Health Agency reports measles cases in the first 6 months of this year were the highest since 2006. To date, it reports 365,000 cases, nearly three times as many as the same period last year. The agency notes the actual number of cases is substantially higher because fewer than 1 in 10 cases gets reported. So far this year, WHO reports a 900% rise in measles cases in the African region, followed by a 230% increase in the Western Pacific region and 120% in the European region. Only the Southeast Asian and Americas regions appear to be coming to grips with the disease. Both show a 15% drop in cases. The World Health Organization notes the Democratic Republic of Congo, Madagascar, and Ukraine report the highest numbers of cases this year. But WHO spokesman Christian Lindmeier says Madagascar is turning things around for the better.
As part of a good news, due to a nationwide emergency measles vaccine campaigns in Madagascar, the cases have dramatically decreased in the past several months. So yet they're amongst the highest. This highlights again how effective vaccination is in ending outbreaks and protecting health.
WHO says measles is almost entirely preventable with two doses of a safe, highly effective vaccine. Those who are not covered, it warns, are at risk of serious illness, disability, and even death. Lindmeier says people do not get vaccinated for a variety of reasons. He says it cannot be nailed down to a single cause. For example, he says the anti-vaccination movement and misinformation have a big impact in some communities and countries and not in others.
More important is also the access to healthcare services, the access to drugs, to quality healthcare, availability, also conflict and displacement of people. So many factors come together, and in each community it's a different reason or a combination of different reasons.
WHO reports measles is spreading in a number of countries among older children, youth, and adults who have missed out on vaccination in the past. The agency is urging everyone to ensure their measles vaccinations are up to date. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
You're listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. We'll be back with more after this VOA programming note.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, historically black colleges and universities in the United States have also educated prominent Africans, like the founding presidents of Nigeria, Ghana, and Malawi. The role of historically black colleges and universities on the continent on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
A recent analysis of 124 years of U.S. climate data by the Washington Post newspaper shows that average temperatures are rising faster in the northeastern United States than in most other parts of the country. To help us understand these changes and the factors that may be contributing to them, VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with New Jersey State climatologist Dave Robinson of Rutgers University.
Yeah, what we've seen in the northeastern portion of the United States is some of the larger amounts of warming seen across the contiguous 48 United States. And some areas are hot spots, if you will, and that includes my home state of New Jersey and coastal northeastern states, going from New England down through the New York metropolitan area into New Jersey and points a little bit further south.
I know climate scientists are uncertain about just why temperatures have been rising so much along America's northeastern coast in particular. But are there some good educated guesses, at least?
It very well may be due to warming of ocean waters off our coast. And that does include the Gulf Stream, which is one of the major poleward-moving warm currents in the Earth's oceans. It is the major main one in the Atlantic Ocean.
I understand that melting glaciers up in the Arctic also play a significant role.
Well, yeah, there's a change in the fluxes of water up in the polar regions. Cold water, that's dense water, as opposed to the warm, salty water, which comes up with the Gulf Stream. And that may be slowing the circulation in the Atlantic Basin. And with that, a slowing of the Gulf Stream might actually have some impacts on sea level rise along the eastern coast of the United States, exacerbating it to levels not seen elsewhere in different parts of the world. When it comes to sea level, everywhere isn't changing or expected to change at the same pace or at the same amount. But the fact is, overall, we're seeing a picture of atmospheric warming, ocean warming, sea level rise globally.
It's a little surprising to me that temperatures are rising so high and so fast in the American Northeast, as opposed to, say, the high plains in the middle of the country, which I've always thought of as much hotter and much drier.
Yeah, well, the high plains actually are warming as much as just about any place in the lower 48 states. And that may be associated with the loss of winter snow cover, which helps to chill the atmosphere. When you don't have as much or long-lasting a snow cover, that can warm the atmosphere. The desert Southwest is getting warmer as well, down into the Los Angeles basin. And then you get to some high-altitude areas, which gets into atmospheric circulation and the changing structure of our atmosphere. And we're just talking middle latitudes. Up in the polar regions, particularly the northern polar regions, the warming is happening at 2, 3, perhaps even 4 times the rate at which is occurring in the middle latitudes and certainly within the tropics.
I would have thought that hotter temperatures would be more extreme in tropical zones, such as equatorial Africa, for example.
It's more subtle in the tropics. The seasons are primarily dictated by whether it's wet or dry. And I might add that those couple degrees Celsius are a global average. It may only be a half or 1 degree right at the equator, but overall, everything is pointing to the fact that our